Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl.
Oh, hi, I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart. Oh, hi. Each week, we get smart together about all things tech, economics, and culture. Or we try. Goodness.
We try. And you help us, too, because, you know, the way, you know what we say, right? Nobody is as smart as all of us. And if you guys were smart right now, you would know where my water glass is. I'm actually dead serious. Wait, hang on. Oh, there it is.
Uh-oh, sorry. Mayday,
okay.
Mayday.
I got it, right? I mean, come on, I'm going to be in here for like 45 minutes. I need water. Anyway, okay, so.
Oh, man, I have two beverages.
Really?
Yeah, I got a coffee and
you got
a water.
Bourbon and
like
water.
You need a whole.
No, sorry, just kidding.
The bourbon is a constant, friends. See, smarter already.
All right.
Here is what's going to happen today. I think, brought this up on a recent show, as so often happens in real time, and then our producers were like, okay, if you say so. We're going to talk about the U.S. and China and whether we are entering, or as I believe we both predicted when we talked about this, when we had the same news fix.
Right.
That we have, in fact, entered at least a business cold war at a minimum with China and what that means. And we're going to talk about it kind of broadly, but largely in the context of Huawei, the Chinese tech giant that has been under all kinds of fire from the White House. And most recently, of course, was banned from doing business with U.S. companies. That means that Google now is not going to like allow Huawei to use its official version of Android, so that people who buy those smartphones can't use official Google services. It's a huge deal. Huawei's losing all these other partnerships. There's questions about what's going to happen with 5G. There was a great Wall Street Journal story, actually, about detailing sort of an entire decade of all the ways that Huawei has engaged in spying and theft from U.S. companies. So it's basically the proxy.
Yeah.
For the
yeah.
Cold War.
It's totally huge. So we're going to talk 5G. We're going to talk Huawei. We're going to talk all of that good stuff, and then we're all going to leave smarter, because honestly, that's what this is all about. Stephen Overly is a technology reporter for Politico. He's in our you're in our Washington bureau, right? I can look and see. Yes, you are, in fact, in our Washington bureau. Stephen, thanks a lot for coming in. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you all for having me on.
So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask a very basic question first, so we all know what we're talking about. Okay.
Yeah.
What is 5G, and why does it matter?
Oh,
it's a great question. So 5G stands for fifth generation, and it refers to the network that really powers all of our connected devices, particularly smartphones. And so the reason it matters is it's much faster and has much lower latency than the networks we have now. And that's going to essentially empower all of our devices to move more quickly, to process more complicated sort of transactions of our data, and really open up kind of new uses for technology that we're already, frankly, using all the time.
Yeah. Latency is just that little, I mean, literally, latency is that lag that we get between me and Molly in Oakland and you in D.C., right? I mean, that's what we're talking about. It's just zippier and faster.
That's exactly okay, right. You know, the most simple example is sort of you'll be able to download a video much faster or download a song much faster than what you could do right now.
Okay.
Bueno. And also connect, and this is what's especially important for the sort of Internet of Things going forward, connect more devices simultaneously without lag. Like, you know how your internet is slower during peak times because everybody's on it? In theory, that should not happen with 5G. You should be able to connect 100 times as many devices without slowing down the delivery of the network services.
Okay.
And that's where this all starts, right, Stephen? Like, this is like 5G and the economic juggernaut that everybody has sort of been predicting it'll be is really what was at the heart of the beginning of this spat with Huawei.
Certainly, it's raised the stakes, because right now the U.S. and China are both in this race to deploy 5G and kind of be the first to really control what these networks look like. And to your point, you know, it will open up kind of a whole new wave of telecommunications, including things like self-driving cars, for example, or automated machinery on a factory floor. You know, all of that could be running on 5G networks. And so we have sort of this battle over who shapes what those networks look like. Will it be the U.S. and sort of the Western world, or will it be China?
Is it like a first mover thing? I mean, if Huawei, so Huawei's huge, right? And I do want you to give a little parenthetical, like 30 second on what Huawei is, right? But if Huawei gets there first, if they get 5G implemented wide scale first, do they get to decide what the standards are? Is that why it matters?
That's a big component of it. So basically, there are international bodies that meet to establish standards around these systems, because obviously, you know, we're communicating and sending data worldwide. These aren't really defined by geographic barriers. And so you have these global bodies that kind of convene and establish rules for what these networks look like. Huawei has a lot of influence there, as do U.S. companies and European companies. But really, as this network is being shaped, it's sort of a question of who's going to have the most influence over how these networks operate. And I hate to use this word, but the values on which these networks operate. That's something you hear a lot of folks talking about now.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, and part of the values, in the case of Huawei, is that there are concerns that the Chinese government could at any time essentially say to Huawei, oh, good job installing a whole bunch of network infrastructure around sensitive areas in the United States or for businesses. Go ahead and install some backdoors and spy on us.
Right.
Spy on them for us,
or
right?
Is Huawei communist, I think, is a simpler way to answer that question.
Yeah.
Right?
Look at this guy, always with the pithier version of my...
That's what I want to know.
Yeah. Are they commies?
Right. Well, and that's right. It's sort of the U.S. has positioned this as kind of, do you want these networks to be the free exchange of ideas and expression and information and sort of have transparency and have the rule of law dictating them? Or do you leave them in the hands of China, you know, a sort of communist regime where the rule of law certainly isn't what it is in the United States, where the government does have, you know, very tight relationships with companies and perhaps backdoors into this technology? You know, that's kind of the dichotomy that's being presented here. And one of the reasons why we're seeing kind of this tech war that you spoke of.
So how bad is the tech war? I mean, this is being described, you know, the Huawei move is being described as really sort of like the Iron Curtain of this brewing Cold War. Is it that serious, in your opinion?
It is pretty serious because, you know, this started, and it still is, a trade war, right? Which is sort of a broader category that has involved tariffs, and we've seen rounds and rounds of negotiations. But really, at the start of the trade war, there was a lot of talk about something called tech transfer or IP theft. Yeah. Basically, this idea that for a long time, Chinese companies have been taking technology created by U.S. companies and replicating it and sort of advancing their own innovation on the backs of U.S. invention, right? That's sort of been kind of core to the whole trade war. And really what's made it even more of a tech war now is this focus on Huawei and the constant drumbeat of rhetoric about, you know, 5G and protecting the advancement of technology here in the U.S. And so it is pretty serious. I think, the latest moves that the administration has taken on Huawei really have escalated things quite a bit. You know, this is one of China's largest and most successful companies. They have more smartphones around the world than Apple. Just to give you some perspective, they are the world's largest provider of telecommunications equipment and have networks that, you know, they support all over the world. So this is a massive company. And the fact that the U.S. has really taken a direct hit at it has just escalated the tension we have with China significantly.
Do you think it's possible to bifurcate the globalized technology supply chain in that, you know, we will shut off the United States and maybe some Europeans will follow along. We'll shut off Huawei and they will go and develop the China internal 5G and the rest of us will figure it out by ourselves and do our own. Is that possible?
Possible, perhaps. But, you know, you have to think about the reality of the internet today, which is that there are not geographic borders. I mean, to some extent, there are certain restrictions, and you certainly see that in countries with authoritarian regimes where you can't access certain websites or certain information is restricted. But so much of commerce and communication is trending toward globalization, right? Toward, you know, moving across borders without sort of any barrier. And so if we have this bifurcated internet that's really deeply entrenched and you have kind of an us versus them approach to the internet, it's really going to complicate global commerce and global diplomacy with, you know, in this case, the largest trading partner of the United States. So, you know, it's not exactly an easy future for a lot of companies here.
Sure.
Well, and we should say, too, that there is an argument to be made that if you're Apple or you're Google, which has sort of been taking these baby steps toward introducing services into China, or Facebook, which desperately want, I mean, there are a lot of American companies who need the Chinese market. Maybe more than, let's say, Huawei, which is already the second largest smartphone maker in the entire world, needs the U.S. market. Like, what is the, you know, long term, how does this start to play out for American businesses?
First of all, China is a huge market. Not only does it have, you know, the largest population in the world, and sort of growing, you know, a growing middle class, potential consumers for these companies, right? They see it as a very lucrative market. But it's also where a lot of them do manufacturing. You mentioned Apple. Apple has a massive manufacturing presence in China, ships a lot of its iPhones and other devices from there to sell them here in the U.S. and around the world. And so they really can't afford to be shut out of the Chinese market. You know, that's they are sort of very deeply entrenched there. You know, similarly, you have a lot of companies in the U.S. that sell products into China, and including selling products directly to Huawei. You know, that's one of the direct effects of this entity list designation or this kind of trade blacklist that the administration, the Trump administration has put Huawei on, is that it prevents U.S. companies from really selling their goods to Huawei. And that's going to directly affect big U.S. companies like Intel or Qualcomm, Micron, sort of some of these that make chips that go into a lot of these devices.
Okay, so Qualcomm really cares. Intel really cares. If I am going about my daily thing and going to work and picking up the kids from baseball practice and, you know, I got a smartphone and that's fine. My self-driving car is not going to be here for 15 years anyway, and I don't want my fridge to tell me how much milk I have. Why do I care?
You know, on the one hand, Huawei's technology is not pervasive here in the United States. You know, some rural broadband providers use Huawei technology, but really it's a small, small part of the U.S. market. And so if there's a disruption to Huawei technology here, most consumers are not going to feel it. But there are still reasons to care, one of which I mentioned is kind of this future where we will all eventually be impacted by 5G. Mm-hmm. We will all eventually have devices in our pocket, in our homes, in our workplaces that run on 5G technology, even if you don't have a self-driving car or a smart refrigerator. Right. And so, you know, you probably care about how the data you transmit through those devices is packaged and communicated and secured, right? You know, we've seen already this sort of groundswell of interest in privacy and concern about how our data is manipulated. And so I think that plays at hand here. Secondly, you know, this is a tech war, but it is a trade war. It affects broader industry. And so to the extent that our trade relations with China are being, you know, compromised here, that's going to reverberate around the economy in ways that consumers could feel directly.
Huh.
I also, I have this sort of theory that regular listeners of this podcast will have heard many more times than they want to.
Oh, no.
About China's parallel tech economy. And that especially as the sort of Iron Curtain drops, right? Let's say it really is dropping and Huawei is forced to, as we've heard, develop its own smartphone operating system, which does not exist. I mean, we have a duopoly of phone operating systems right now with Android and iOS, or is forced to, you know, really aggressively develop 5G technologies and sell it to lots of other countries that are still willing to engage in trade, or that these moves sort of force it to accelerate the kind of Beijing 2025 operations that China's already put into place around becoming a tech giant. Like, I just wonder to what extent this Cold War might actually accelerate technological development within China and make it even more of a competitive force to these American tech giants.
I think that's a great point. You know, you talk to Chinese national security experts and economic experts, and a lot of them say, you know, China would like to do away with a lot of these U.S. tech companies. You know, part of the reason there have been these issues with IP theft is China wants and is already building its own very strong, very robust tech economy. And, you know, Huawei smartphones are on par with some smartphones created by Western providers. And some of their 5G technology is cheaper and on par with some provided by the Western world if you listen to their customers. And so China is moving very strongly ahead toward that future. You know, they're investing very heavily in not only 5G, but things like artificial intelligence and quantum computing. And they're really trying to create this future where China is the dominant global player in tech. And so if you do cut off these U.S. tech companies, that very well could force them to expedite that process, to increase their own production of technology and sort of increase their own investment in research and development. Now, you know, it's a bit unclear how quickly that can realistically happen. You know, I do think that there will be a direct effect on Huawei if they are cut off from U.S. companies, because right now they do rely heavily on these chips for their devices. But you know, they're working toward a future where they don't. Huawei has said that, and that's certainly part of the Chinese government's priorities.
All right, so I'm going to timestamp something here. I will say in advance, it is deeply, deeply cynical, but I think it's in line with other things that I have said on this podcast, and it goes like this. I would bet you right now, sitting here in May of 2019, that sometime along about March, April, May of 2020, the White House is going to announce, miraculously, that the Chinese trade war has been solved and everything's fine. Okay. Now, setting that aside, does that mean that the Huawei thing is all going to be good and it's going to be solved and everything's fine?
Your cynicism would be at home here in Washington, I think, on that one. So I'm familiar with the argument. The Trump administration has already suggested that all of this tension with Huawei could be wrapped up in and resolved as part of the trade negotiations with China. Here's where that gets complicated. You know, the justification that the Trump administration has given for the actions it's taking against Huawei are rooted in national security. Mm-hmm. Earlier this year in January, the Justice Department indicted Huawei and one of its main executives on a broad range of charges dealing with sanctions against Iran and trade theft, right?
Right.
Those don't necessarily go away just because this trade war has been resolved. And if they do, that raises questions about how serious these national security questions were to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, are we conflating kind of economic protectionism with national security, which is something that past administrations have traditionally tried to avoid and have criticized other countries for doing. So, you know, we may well see that some of these penalties against Huawei go away as part of a trade deal, but you still have lawmakers in Washington who see this company as a national security threat. Mm. And you still are going to have folks criticizing that decision if it does come to pass. There's just one recent example of this was another Chinese telecom company called ZTE, which went down a similar path, was put on this same blacklist, was basically facing extinction as a result. And the Chinese government intervened and asked the Trump administration to intervene, and they did.
And a billion-dollar fine later, they were done, right? Everything was fine.
Right. Mm-hmm. A billion-dollar fine and some shakeup of their management.
Right.
But ultimately, you know, they were no longer impacted by being on this blacklist. And you saw a lot of backlash, including from some Republicans who questioned whether we were basically trading national security for kind of economic gain.
Right.
And so you will undoubtedly see similar arguments if that happens with Huawei.
Stephen Overly covers technology for Politico. It's still a mess. I'm just saying this whole 5G thing is still a mess. Stephen, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Stephen.
Yeah. Thank you both.
See ya. Well, there we go. Now we know.
There we go. I feel smarter and yet vaguely cynical and
Well, welcome to the podcast.
Trying not to go. I'm not going there. I think that I was trying to rescue myself from the morass of the whatever. But I will say that I am officially, as of this moment, putting 5G in the same bucket as the self-driving cars. Like, if you think it's coming nationwide at the level that everybody's talking about anytime soon, just take a look at this episode for like,
Right. Totally.
No. And tell us what you think. I know that we have listeners in Europe, Asia, and Australia. I know some people here in the U.S. I have certainly ogled the Huawei phones. Like, they're beautiful and super fancy.
Are they really?
And you could buy them. I wonder if anybody... Yeah, they're gorgeous. I mean, they're really nice phones.
How much do they cost?
So, yeah. If you... You know, same. Same as any sort of premium smartphone.
Wow.
Yeah, $1,000. But you can get... There's cheaper ones and just like all of them. But yes, if you live in Europe, Asia, and Australia, and you have a Huawei phone, and you're worried about losing access to like official Google services, or you have thoughts on this topic, let us know. Send us a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org on that, or really any other topic.
Any other. Anything that's on your mind. All right. We'll be back. Hang on. And here we are again. It's kind of amazing. It's kind of amazing that we come back every
the
single
magic
time.
Of technology.
We should just not come back one time. Just hit that sting and just totally sit here for
like a beat. That would be amazing.
Wait, what?
It just stops like, what happened?
Technology?
God. Right. People will be like tapping their phones. Oh, no.
Well,
you know, one
thing. Yes.
What? I'm going to go. I know we're headed for our fixations, yes. But I'm going to back up a little bit and say that the subplot to all of this is Qualcomm. And we shouldn't underestimate the potential protectionism of Qualcomm that's part of this, because they're sort of the other big 5G network
provider.
Giant,
enormous American chip company.
Huge American chip company, really, really wants to be the leader in 5G, and was smacked down when it tried to acquire a competitor. And I think there's a whole, not that we need to, stand down, producers. This does not need to be another episode. But I do think it's a really big subplot in all of this.
You want to go first? Am I going first? What's going on?
You go ahead, because I'm very intrigued by your link here.
Oh, are you really?
I didn't expect you to be going this way.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So it's not the actual link itself. It's what happened after. So as those of you who are news aware know, late last week, there were actually a couple of doctored videos put out of Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi that made it look as if she was slurring her words, incoherent in a sense, and just very bad looking for the Speaker of the House. Rudy Giuliani tweeted it out. I think the president might have tweeted something
about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, so anyway, it got a lot of play at those levels of the American government, which is interesting. But the really interesting thing about it was that Facebook's response, right? The thing got posted to Facebook, and it got shared umpteen gazillion times, as things do on Facebook. And Facebook's response was, we can't take this down because it's not a violation of our terms of service to put up things that aren't true.
Mm-hmm.
And what? Are you kidding? Shut up. Come on, man.
And the follow-on was, there was a CNN interview with Monica Bickert and Anderson Cooper.
Monica
and
Bickert seemed, is some higher up at Facebook,
she's
right?
She's like the head of marketing or something at Facebook. And he was incredulous at the sort of typical Facebook response, which is like, look, we're not a publisher. We're a platform. We don't think that it's our place to make determinations about speech.
Could I digress here for a moment and have you give a brief disquisition on Section 230 of the whatever it is act that lets them get away with this?
Oh, the 1996 Communications Decency Act?
Well, yes, that one. Yes, please do. Section 230. Begin.
So Section 230 is the statute in this Communications Decency Act, which essentially says that a platform, an internet platform, is not liable for things that people post on that platform, assuming those things are legal, by the way. So they are liable for, like, and they always were, for prostitution ads or ads for drugs or things like that. But if it's legal content, they cannot be sued for it. And this, you know, made a lot of sense in the early days of the internet. If you were a tiny little internet service provider and somebody, you know, put up something that was derogatory or defamatory or not true or fraudulent, that you, internet service provider, should not get sued out of existence because of something that some jerk posted on your platform. And it is the foundational regulation. It has allowed the internet as we know it to develop. It's why we have Google, and Google didn't get sued out of existence, and Facebook, and Twitter, and Reddit, and all of these places where people can post things.
So here comes the follow.
And they're responsible, Yeah.
Do you think it is time to revisit, God, I can't speak this morning. Do you think it's time to revisit Section 232? That one, the one. Do you think it's time to talk about it again?
I do think it is time to talk about it again.
She says with a caveat in her voice.
I mean, look,
I know.
The question is it time to unwind the existing internet economy as we know it? Because that's what we'd have to talk about.
Well, like, I think that's a bit of a too grand statement, right? How do you get from Facebook being able to say, sorry, our terms of service don't include things that aren't true, to we have to unwind the internet economy? I think that's a leap.
Well, I guess it depends on, okay, yes, it is a leap. But that is the extreme version, yes, conclusion of examining, right, 230 in the way that some critics have talked about. And we're all, and re-examining 230 means putting a platform like Facebook or Twitter or Reddit firmly in charge of speech. And in the case of Facebook, they're firmly in charge of speech in a way that affects 2 billion people. And they already are, in ways that know are super disturbing. I mean, this is the same old conversation that we're always having about Twitter. Like, I don't feel comfortable with those weirdos at Facebook making these speech decisions. It makes me nervous.
Okay, so what's a better answer? Because this is,
I guess,
this is
that
nutty.
Facebook shouldn't be so big.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that
I mean, this is nutty, but. It's not like Facebook didn't do anything, right? They put warnings in front of it that said this is probably false. Like, before you share this, you should know that it's been fact checked and it's most likely not true.
Most likely not true. It's most likely that this doctored video, which the New York Times
maybe they said is not true.
Yeah. All right. Anyway. All right.
Like, this is, I don't this know. Is a longer maybe thing, it's but. digital literacy. It's a huge issue. Like, now this is worth a follow up episode. Like, the idea of speech and platforms. Is Sharon in there freaking out?
She's not yet.
But like, the question of speech and platforms is going to be the question of the next few years, because this is like what it all comes down to. And these deep fakes are so good. Like, these videos are so, and this is what security experts have been warning about for
a long
time.
Real quick, deep fakes are
videos that are so perfectly doctored, right, videos and images that are so perfectly doctored that even experts cannot tell the difference, let alone like partisan dum-dums who are dying to believe whatever their friends tell them about the evil other side.
Did you see the one the other day with Steve Buscemi's face on Jennifer Lawrence's body? Deeply disturbing.
Yeah.
Deeply disturbing.
And that's how good they are. Right. So they're really good. And so it does become, it gets, but like, look, then Zuckerberg's answer is just like, put an AI in charge of it. And that's not better.
But look, do you not think it's time to begin these conversations? Because Mark Zuckerberg has demonstrated time. Okay. Okay. All right. I 100% agree.
I just think like they can't be in charge. I think they need like a civilian council. You know, like there needs to be like a UN
nothing ominous
for
there.
Facebook.
Oh, they're bringing the black helicopters for Facebook. You can see it now.
No, it could be elected. It could be like an elected body.
Like the Congress?
But Facebook can't
so
be in charge.
Sorry.
Oh, biscuits. You don't even want answers.
No, I do. I totally do. But look, this is, I mean, these are the kinds of conversations we have to have, right?
We have to have them. Right? I think that is 100% true. We have to have them.
All right. Anyway, because, your turn. Yeah. Your turn.
Because we're both right.
Yeah. We're both. That's true. That's right. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Go.
Definitely. Because we have talked about privacy and Huawei, and because Apple, bless them, cannot stop advertising what a big, huge private, like, fortress they are for your information, I was delighted, actually, and horrified to see this story in the Washington Post by Jeffrey Fowler about how apps on your phone, lots of media apps, just saying, but all kinds, Nike, Spotify, Microsoft OneDrive, the Washington Post, IBM's Weather Channel, are pretty much constantly and largely in violation of their published privacy policies, sharing all kinds of data about you, your IP address, where you live, like how often you've checked it, your trackers, the things that you've done on your phone, all of this stuff. There's been plenty of reporting about it around Android, but it is also happening on your iPhone. And like I've said this before, I think even on this show, that for example, Apple can say that their phone and their messaging is as private as they want, but you're still running on Verizon, and Verizon's still tracking everything you do and possibly giving it to the NSA still. And so are the apps. And like, frankly, the biggest ongoing privacy violation in my life is iMessage, which keeps turning itself back on my iPad and my laptop so that my kid is like, I see you texting about wanting to send me to camp with that kid that I don't want to go to camp with.
Oh,
I mean, I'm just lucky that that's like all that he's seen on, you know.
Oof. Yes.
Uh-huh. Anyway, I'm just saying, like, at this point, there's what companies mean when they say privacy, And there's the things that they're doing when they interact with all these other companies, and they are not, it is not what you think they mean.
Right, because companies say privacy, 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 and listeners hear, oh, yeah, I'm safe now, and that's really not what that is. That's not an accurate
translation. They're still trying to sell you something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
And then I have a second one.
Yeah, of course you
do. Just a quick follow-up.
Oh, I saw this one. All right, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Because remember when I said aliens were like a thing?
Yes.
Turns out the New York Times and I think the History Channel have collaborated on this huge thing looking at all these UFOs that all of these Navy pilots were reporting from 2014 to 2015, all these interactions they had with super weird UFOs, and now there's going to be a whole show about it.
So, Molly.
Yes.
As the person in this conversation with the naval aviation background?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they're not aliens.
Oh, no one's actually saying they're aliens. Right. They're just crazy unexplained. Look, if they're not aliens, that's almost worse because that means somebody has like extremely good technology and we don't know where it came from.
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's somebody experimenting with really good technology. Maybe it's us. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the Russians. Maybe it's Huawei. Maybe it's Apple.
Maybe it's Huawei.
Could be. Could totally be Apple. Self-driving car. We're going with spaceships, right? You can see Tim Cook saying that.
We're going with spaceships. Right? I can see that happening. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. It's actually the campus. This whole time, it's been the Apple Cupertino campus just flying around.
You see, I mean, you see the thing from the air, right? It's a big circle, and it hovers, and, you know, that's totally it. All right.
UFOs. Oh, my God.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Amen, my brother.
I love how the producers have written in here, save us from ourselves.
Yes.
Who, us?
Yes.
What?
They don't mean us. They mean somebody else.
Last week, we discussed how an antitrust movement referred to in the parlance as the new Brandeis School has pushed this, you know, for everybody who's like totally up on their Brandeis.
Right, in the parlance.
In the parlance. Yes. Has pushed the antitrust conversation into the mainstream, specifically against these big tech companies that
we've
talked about.
As we were just talking about. Yes.
All day. Laramie Green from Santa Barbara might, in fact, be part of the new Brandeis School because he thinks that we should go even further than breaking up Facebook.
Facebook doesn't provide any essential business services. If Facebook were to go away today, I don't think the world's going to change one bit. I don't think the economy changes.
Really?
Laramie, thank you so much for listening. But yo, dude, that just you're just not correct.
I just put a little into DuckDuckGo real quick. Total size of the digital advertising economy, which I believe is going to be Facebook's got about 40-something percent of that. It will be a $333 billion market in 2019, digital ad spending.
And it's only going up from there.
And it's only going up from there. And I would say that for all of the businesses, businesses.
Those small businesses, right.
Yeah, who get all of their business from Facebook, that it feels pretty essential. And it's one of the things we keep talking about is why it's so hard to unwind, we mentioned earlier, from this existing economy. It's a huge deal.
But hey, thanks for writing in.
I mean, it could also go away and people would find different places to advertise and whatever.
All right. Neil in Rockville hit us up on Twitter. He said, the new Brandeisian antitrust sounds a lot like a move toward unicorns and rainbows, which I imagine means he doesn't think it's going to happen or exist, which, you know, could be. I mean, we'll see. We'll see, right? Who knows? Who knows?
Yes, we will. Yeah. It's a matter of will. Certainly, Europe is headed hard toward unicorns and rainbows, and we'll see who ends up in the White House in 2020. And then we'll know a lot more. Make Me Smart question time. What is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? Listener Megan McCarthy sent us this one.
So the thing that I thought that I knew was that I was a terrible student. I, you know, barely graduated from anything because I just never was very dedicated about actually, you know, turning in work on time or stuff like that. And I just finished a course on teaching English as a second language. So I now have my teacher certification and it was amazing. I kicked ass. I feel like it just changed my whole perception of myself and what I'm capable of.
That is awesome. I love that.
Aww,
that's really good, right?
That's amazing.
Yeah. That was really cool.
Also, good job.
Yeah.
Way to go.
Totally.
You know, what's great about it is that now you can go and try to recognize the things that made you feel like not a good student and like fix it for future students. And it just becomes this whole virtuous cycle of teaching.
No, it's totally cool.
Oh, teachers.
Yeah.
There's a like funny little prompt question in here that says, what kind of students were you? And I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, we're not. I'm
it's just best if we don't
finish with my being a student.
What I'm a student of life every day. What is your answer to the make me smart question? Which one more time is what's something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? Send us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org. It's our favorite part.
That's our favorite part? Is it really?
I don't know if it's my favorite part. Okay. I love this part.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right. Just checking.
I guess all the parts are my favorite part.
There you go.
Really.
Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Morris. The senior producer of this podcast is Eve Troh. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore. I'm pretty sure Ben did all the heavy lifting this week.
And also Molly Wood.
Also,
I produced my own.
I don't think you get to do that. Although it's like when Ira says on This American Life. The show today was produced by me. Oh, shut up. Anyway.
Me? Yeah, no, you're right. You know what? I take that back.
There
Just edit that out.
There you go.
This week's program was engineered by the one and only Charlton Thorpe, I hope. Our theme music was composed, by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sacharan Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager. They gave me this line because they thought maybe I might not say it. Who doesn't listen to the end of the show? Deborah Clark.
We'll never know. Boom. Another day, another dollar, people.
It is a fun show. You're
another
right.
Another day, another dollar.
The whole thing.
Yep.
Is my favorite thing.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.